It's that time of week, the time you've been waiting for. It's time for Goat Gab, a weekly podcast about all things in the dairy goat industry. Sit back and enjoy an hour or so with your hosts, Laura Warren Hughes and Cameron Jedlowski, as we talk about ideas and topics that matter to the dairy goat world.
Welcome back, Goat Gabbers, to another exciting episode, and truly exciting, and I can't wait for this episode to start here with some awesome special guests. And as always, not only our special guests, I'm joined by my good friend and alpine enthusiast, Laura Warren Hughes.
Hi, guys. We are so glad to be here. Cameron actually is the guy who set this up. I'm going to let him introduce our exciting guests, and I am just as thrilled as he is, so...
Yes. So tonight we are joined by Nate Funk and Brandy Giacchino talking about something that's very near and dear to their heart. Brandy, did I mess up your last name?
No, you got it right. I was like, yes.
I heard the yes. Good goodness. I screwed it up the first few times I tried saying it.
Brandy, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you're from and what your herd names are. And then Nate, why don't you jump in after her?
Okay.
Okay. My name is Brandy Giacchino, and I live in North Idaho, about an hour and a half from Canada. I've been raising primarily Oberhausley since 2009. My daughters and I do this as a joint venture. My herd name is Van Just. My older daughter, Vanessa Mills, her herd name is Love Ruck. And then my younger daughter, Emma, her herd name is DeHuen, is how it's pronounced. And if you see any of those herd names, they're all from the same gene pool of animals. It's all the same group of animals. So, yeah.
Well, and I'm Nathan Funk. We're from Central New York. The long story short, I grew up growing up with animals, with Oberhausleys in 1980s up through the 90s, early 2000s. Took a brief break, got back into it probably about, I guess, 5 to 7 years ago. And we're here, yeah, as I said, in Central New York. Got a good background of history and looking towards the future. So, yeah.
So just out of curiosity, guys, both of you, about how many animals do you have on your farm? And I know that's always a loaded question, but a general number.
The number of animals I have is the number I have.
I have 4 bucks and 39 does.
You do have an exact number. Okay.
Only because I counted papers the other day. That's the only reason I know.
Okay. We actually have about, I think we're at 24 does and 4 bucks on our property. So we're just a little less than Brandy there.
So is this like an Alcoholics Anonymous type group where, you know, you don't really want to come clean until you see that the guy sitting next to you is just as bad as you are? Is that how it goes?
Oh, I feel so much better knowing that Funks have that many goats.
I counted my goats today, and I told my son, I said, you know what? Hey, I said, I feel pretty good. I've got under 30 goats here. And he's like, well, I thought you had about 22. I don't feel so good now.
Goat math is hard.
Goat math is hard.
Oh, it is. It is.
I think we need t-shirts that say that.
Oh, definitely.
Well, talking about our numbers of goats here, Nate, why don't you start off? Tell us what's happening on your farm in the last couple of weeks there, or talk about your breeding season.
Well, actually, so our breeding season, we're kind of winding down. We've got 3 does left. No, 5 does left to breed. We have 2 does that we're breeding later in the season just because they're older does. And then we have 3 does that we had false pregnancy issues with, which we discovered doing ultrasounds. So we've done a loop cystrillin protocol to clean out those and try to reset everything. So breeding season's kind of winding down. The bucks are a little frustrated. They think there should be more does. So we've been, just as insurance policy, collecting them when a doe does come in heat. That's what we're doing. Just that and getting ready for winter. Winter comes early here. So as it does for Brandy. Shucks, she's already had snow.
Yeah, we had snow a couple of days ago, and it's supposed to be down to 10 degrees on Tuesday. So,
you could keep that.
Yeah, it's pretty miserable.
Yeah. So, Brandy, how do you avoid all that? I notice on the Facebook, which we're friends, and you breed a lot of goats early. Is that because it's so cold, or you just want to get started?
I find for my particular herd that my kids grow much faster and they're a lot healthier if we kid out in January and February. When March comes around and there's breakup, the coccidia just kind of takes over, and it doesn't matter how clean you are or how many preventative ways you try to prevent it. Boy, that sounds dumb. Anyway, they just don't seem to grow as well when they're born much later than mid-March. So, and I like big growthy kids. You know, the Oberhausli is not a very large breed to begin with. And so when you bring in your Oberhausli kids that are really growthy and you're thinking, oh, yay, she's got some good size to her. And then she's standing in the best in show lineup and you've got these Alpines that look like dry yearling Oberhausli. You want to make sure that the Oberhausli are, you know, given every chance that they can get to grow as well as they're going to grow. So that's why we generally kid out in January and February. So
we kid out in January, February for much of the same reason. You know, cause January, February kids, as Brandy said, they seem to do better. The other thing is if you breed out for January, February kids, that growthiness comes through. And if you're thinking about having milking yearlings, we generally try not to breed doe kids who were born after April 1st, just because they're not going to be of size. So, you know, in March, kids kind of, you know, we watch them and we look at their, you know, the bloodlines. Was the dam small? Is the sire throw small kids? You know, those January, February kids are more apt to become milking yearlings in our herd. We aim for that January, February line too.
Because a January, February Oberhausli kid is just at 70 or 80 pounds by October. Yep. So, and that's the magic number that everybody seems to like for breeding kids to freshen as yearlings. So, you know, they're 10 months old before they hit that weight. They're just not a big goat, you know, and they figure that their adult weight is probably between 140 and 150. It's taken a while to get to that size.
Well, I think Cameron and I have talked before, you know, I know that he's said his kind of scientific poll of animals that are more apt to be kept in his herd are those January and February kids. And I agree, you know, I'm looking at some animals right now in my herd and I'm like, you're not bred. That means we're going to have late kids. But, you know, the fact of the matter is I can totally see that those January and February kids are great. I just didn't know if, you know, being in such a cold environment, I guess they do just fine.
So as people have seen on Facebook, my barn is open. It's a breezeway. A lot of people have enclosed barns and I do not. So the wind blows from the north here. And so we have a wall on the north side of the barn so the goats can get out of the wind. But we feed outside. We also feed in the barn, but we feed outside. And so I like it, my goats to be able to, you know, I want them to be strong and sturdy and healthy. And if they can withstand harsh weather without being babied, then I know that that's going to equate that the same in other herds, in other parts of the country. If they can handle not being babied here, then they can handle not being babied in other herds in the country. So, my babies, when they're born, they're kept in the barn for a couple of days, with a temperature of about 50 degrees. And then when they start to get, you know, get a little bit of body fat on them and stuff, they go out to what we call the baby shed, which is an enclosed, little enclosed shed. And then their body heat keeps it about 40 degrees in there. And then after they're about 10 days old, then they get shoved outside. So the babies, it's a sink or swim deal at my place. If they're healthy enough and they're strong enough and their bloodlines are, I breed for healthy goats. They have to be tough to survive here. If they're weak or they're sickly here, then they're going to be weak and sickly in another herd in another part of the country. And that's not what I want. I want my goats to be able to survive any type of environment across the country.
That makes perfect sense to me. And so, I really appreciate that as a goat enthusiast or someone that might be interested in purchasing goats of yours as well there. I do have a question for you, Brandy. It looks like you just did a project today. Do you want to talk or at least tell us what project you did and maybe why you did it?
We do lots of projects.
you were building a hay shed.
Which one specifically?
The hay shed you were building?
Oh, the hay.
Yeah,
it's just a feeder. So up here, a lot of the hay producers are starting to use those great big square balers. And so those bales of hay are 1,400 pounds and they are really hard to wrestle around. And the way our barn is set up, we can't feed that hay in the inside barn. It doesn't work. But the hay is a lot cheaper. Hay was as much as $400 a ton up here this year, but I got these bales, these 1400 pound bales for $200. So you do the math. I mean, that comes out to what, $250 a ton or something like that. So it's substantially cheaper to feed it like that. So Pete, my boyfriend, he built that feeder for me, and it's really, really cool because we can just go and put those bales inside that feeder and then the goats can just eat as much as they want to eat. And 1400 pounds lasts us about 18 days, with them just free feeding what they want. And I'll throw grass hay on the inside barn so that they have something else to eat besides just high, rich alfalfa. So they'll get grass hay inside the barn too, if they want something, cause you can't just eat prime rib all the time. You got to have some vegetables.
I would like to be at the buffet of Brandy's goats.
Yeah. My hay, I really shouldn't say this, but my hay bill was almost, it was around $25,000 this year was how much my hay cost me. It was insane. It's insane how much hay was this year. So what I do is I sell my babies and I save all the money from the babies sales. And that's how I purchase my hay every year.
So you're saving money with these large bales then?
Definitely. Absolutely. It's about, it's about $250 a ton as opposed to $400 a ton, $350 to $400 a ton.
Wow. So that's just, you know, cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's really, really nice.
Brandy, I was always taught at a young age, if you want the best goats, you have to feed the best hay that you could possibly find. And that's someone else, another Oberhasli enthusiast actually told me that as well. And he would be like, I'm just eating peanut butter sandwiches so my goats can, you know, dine at the Ritz-Carlton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, and kind of like Laura said, this, you know, we're all sort of, all of us goat people are kind of in this together. I think if you're really, really, really serious about what you're doing, then you sacrifice a tremendous amount of personal benefit in order for your animals to eat. And a lot of, you know, there are many times that the goats eat better than we do.
I agree with that there. Laura, what happened this week at your place?
Well, thanks to the help of my daughters, we got all of the big doe's pedicures and copper bolus and did some ultrasounding. So that's always fun when you can kind of take a peek at the inside goings on. So saw some that were bred that were like, woohoo, and others I'm like, I thought you were bred. We're going to have to check back in another week, you know. But it was fun. So, and then this afternoon did one of my absolute favorite things to do. It's really pretty fall weather, about 60 degrees here today, beautiful sunshine. So we went out and sat on the old fallen log in the pen with the kids and had our own form of goat Zen yoga, I guess you could call it. We've learned, though, that the kids are big enough now that it is almost suicide to walk out there with a bag of animal crackers. they mow you down at this point. So you can only feed crackers on the other side of the fence anymore. But once we got through the cracker episode, they were all pretty chill and glad to be just hanging out with their people. So that's always a good mental health thing.
Absolutely there. A whole lot of nothing. It was cold and wet and rainy, and it was like blowing wind, like 30 miles per hour. So a whole lot of nothing. We bred some goats finally. I felt like I hadn't bred goats forever. But some goats finally flagged. So I think I've got four left now to breed. I really don't know. And I don't want to give up, and I won't give up breeding goats, but by golly, some of these goats are just really infuriating. And it's never like the bottom of the totem pole goats. It's never the goats that are like, oh man, like you're like a 17th place goat at nationals. It's never her. It's always the cream of the crops that always give you the most difficulty. So, yeah, it's never.
Definitely. Oh yeah,
it's never the 17th place goat. It's always the third, the fifth. So, you know, those goats that give you the most troubles. And so, dealing with that, and the two Toggenbergs I took to the national show aren't even bred, and now I'm just going crazy on that. So, other than that, we got grain delivered, which is kind of nice. That's a new thing. I don't have to go run and get grain anymore because they just deliver it now to us. So foreign concept to me, but really, really nice up here because we've got enough goat producers and people that buy grain from our little feed store that they'll just come and deliver it for free. So other than that, it is
cool.
It really is now. If I could just get somebody to deliver hay.
I'm kind of envious, actually, Cameron. That's wow. That almost sounds entitled.
They do enough of it, and I asked him. I said, "So why don't you charge?" He's like, "We have so many people over that way that we deliver grain to. Your house is just like right on the route." So I'm like, "Okay." So whenever we need grain, we call on Tuesday, and it's in our barn on Thursday. We just got to leave the barn open.
Oh my gosh.
Well, they don't put it in the right spot, but yeah, they unload it. So I'll take it.
Well,
it's right spot is your house, your property.
Other than the goats got out, it was a quiet week, and they somehow managed to turn the water on in the barn. I don't really understand how, but I blame the Toggenbergs for that. So it's never the Alpines.
I think it's the Alpines.
I think every child has ever grown up with goats. That's the most terrifying set of words. The goats got out!
You know, there's more fights between a family when the goats are out than any other type of, like, thing going on.
All based on who left the gate untied.
The humans are all screaming at each other while everybody's trying to get the goats in. And, oh, yeah, it's terrible. Yeah.
My daughter Elizabeth is sitting here silently laughing over this discussion because she's like, "Yeah, this is totally true. Not good in our house."
But other than that,
I'm sure there are many parallels to everybody's herds.
Other than that, that's it there. I think we're going to skip Ad Good News this week. They had a big release. Really excited about that. We'll get into some details maybe next week about that there. But I want to get focused on the big topic here. And I like to think we're bringing in the big guns of the Oberhausli breed here. And two really, and one up and coming breeder, but with a lot of history, being Nate, and then Brandy as well, who in my mind is one of the top Oberhausli breeders in the nation. So
thank you very
when
much.
When Cameron said that he wanted to start our series, and we've kind of tossed this idea around for a while, start our series with the Oberhauslis, I was like, absolutely, because at the national show this year, and I think I have said this before, of all of the breeds that I was totally blown out of the water with the quality of animals, it was that Oberhausli show. Now, granted, I got a front row seat because I actually got to be the secretary for that breed, but it was every class that walked in, I'm like, look at these animals. These aren't does that you'd look at and say, wow, those are some really nice Oberhauslis. These are does that you would look at and say, these are beautiful dairy goats. You didn't have to say what breed they were because they would be competitive against any breed. They were just phenomenal.
Gives me goosebumps. Thank you.
Well, it's the God honest truth. It really was a beautiful Oberhausli show.
I didn't even have any goats there, but it makes me so happy that the breed as a whole is becoming, is finally being recognized as being as good as Alpines or as good as La Mancha's. You know, it's a beautiful breed, and Oberhausli breeders have worked our butts off to make them the quality that they are now. And to have somebody like you recognize that when, you know, you're not even an Oberhausli person, to have you recognize that and just say, wow, what a beautiful group of animals. It really gives me so much pride. And I have complete goosebumps because I'm like, yes, we're being recognized for what we're doing. That's so freaking cool.
Well, you should. And it wasn't like it was just maybe the top two animals in a class. I mean, mm-hmm. You can look down to the top 10 and 15, and they're still very beautiful, competitive animals. Again, my hat is off to you, Oberhausli breeders, because it was a beautiful show and so much fun to watch. There were animals that I could have seen an argument for several different animals being up there in the grand and reserve spots. They were just beautiful.
Yeah, the breed has really come a long ways quickly. And it was all the way from the top to the bottom. There was really no awful quality animals at the show at all. It was wonderful.
Yeah, it was great to be there to see it. I remember back in 1988 being there, and goodness, we had an Oberhausli doe. I remember way back then she had great general appearance, but not a great memory. And she placed. Now, I may be jumping the gun here, but now I don't think she would have even made the cut. So the quality has definitely gone up. But, that's some of the breeders we'll discuss here in a bit.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit here. The Oberhausli breed is not a big breed, both in size and stature, as well as numbers as well, but I think, as we've kind of talked about here, is it's got tremendous quality and it's really expanding and really growing as well in certain pockets and areas of the country. Thinking about that though, Nate, when you think about the history of the breed there, I'm going to start with Nate first. What do you think of? I mean, you were kind of around-ish. I don't know how old you are, but you were around-ish kind of at the beginnings there.
Well, so, like, I got my first Oberhausli back in 1980, which, realized that they were accepted into ADCA in 1979. That's right about there. for years, They were where the Guernseys are now. They're just starting. They had some definite type issues. And you know, things that needed to be improved upon, that if you're breeding within the breed, you're going to be limited. You know, I was able to see progress, you know, goodness, but it wasn't until the 1990s before we had our first permanent champion. Mainly because we didn't have enough Oberhasleys at most shows to be official. And then, you know, even then, the Oberhasleys were, you know, that doe would make it to the best in show lineup, but, you know, she'd just kind of get mentioned as the judge was moving through the lineup of the animals there. Having seen them back then and seeing what I had in the mid-90s, even the late 90s, it was a definite type difference from the 80s. You know, I remember, you know, Cherry Pie, you know, Body Shop 21 Cherry Pie being national champion. And that was about when I'd say those Oberhasleys started to make a turn in quality.
I would agree with that. She's one that stands out in my mind is just, yeah, that was probably the first Oberhasley I can remember looking at and saying she could hold her own in an alpine ring most of the time. I mean, she was beautiful.
Carol Drona was a very talented breeder. Very talented breeder. She was instrumental in the herd progressing forward in the early stages.
One thing that I kind of noticed, and I was doing a little research as well here about it, is that, you know, in the early 1900s, they actually imported some Oberhasleys into America, and then those kind of either died out or they didn't do it there. And then there was another group imported as well there, which started the purebred Oberhasley line. Do you two want to talk a little bit about kind of purebred Oberhasleys versus American Oberhasleys?
Oh, goodness.
That's a hot topic.
It is. So I'll take one side. We have a purebred doe in our herd. Now, I realize that back, you wondered about what happened that original import way back, that first set in the early 1900s. What happened is they got assimilated. They got bred into the other breeds, into the alpine. They were Swiss alpines. You had French alpines, Swiss alpines, ultimately American alpines. And they showed with the French alpines and the American alpines. So, you know, people often, you know, just bred them in, and it brought in a bit of genetic diversity to the alpine breed. And then that second import came. What?
Oh, I'm sorry. Ignore me.
I'm sorry. And then the second import came, and that's where, yes, the purebred Oberhasley established, I believe, with 5 does. Now, you know, the current purebred Oberhasley, which really there aren't that many of, can trace themselves back, ultimately, all the way back, one way or the other, to those 5 does. So, whereas the Americans they may have some alpine, they may have Saanen, Nubian, something mixed in one way or the other. Though, you know, some of the American Oberhasley were simply, someone decided that their doe was going to be American back in the 1970s and 1980s. It was somebody lapsed on a registration paper, mm-hmm. and they lost that pedigree. The bloodlines may have still been Oberhasley, but there was a lapse on that registration, which meant that purebred doe was now considered, you know, their kids would now grade, and they graded up to American, even though genetically they were Oberhasley. So, you know, there's the big difference as far as, you know, paper and paperwork-wise on American versus purebred.
The purebreds, I think there were 96 purebreds registered in 2021. And and almost 1,800 Americans. So the breed is not very big. The gene pool is very, very small. And I know that a lot of the purebred people are just staunch purebred purists. They won't use any Americans, even if an animal is, you know, 100%, you know how AdGood Genetics has the breed percentage up at the top there. Even if an American says 100% Oberhausley, a purebred breeder will not use an animal from that American doe because they're such purists. And it's a shame because the gene pool for the purebreds is very, very small. And it's very difficult to improve on those purebreds. As Nate mentioned, they have a purebred doe and they've AI'd her to purebred bucks. But she just can't seem to duplicate herself no matter who they breed her to. And so I actually would like to see the Oberhausley Breeders of America write up a proposition to ADGA about opening the Oberhausley herd book again and saying after 10 generations of nothing but Oberhausley, being allowed for that 10th generation animal to become a purebred. Because, you know, if you're breeding nothing but Oberhausley for 10 generations, I'm pretty sure that's probably a purebred at that point. It's probably more of a purebred than even the purebreds are, because the purebred gene pool is so small, and because the purebreds in the 80s weren't necessarily purebreds, if that makes any sense whatsoever. Because they were still Swiss Alpines, they were still considered Alpines up till that point, until they were in the 79. So, I admire the purebred people for being such purists, but I think that they've painted themselves into a corner being so staunch against using an American that is still 10 generations or more of just Oberhausley in the pedigree.
I have a question for you guys. I have heard, I don't know, a rumor, maybe it's true and maybe it's not, maybe you can tell me, that one of the most influential Alpine bucks of all times, Sodium Oak Saison, was in actuality an Oberhausley. Is that true?
So no, he was an Alpine. But
he was an Alpine. Go ahead, Nate. So what you have is, you go back far enough in Saison's pedigree, you're going to find a buck named Playfair Little Beaver. I actually happen to have the toy of every dairy goat breeder at Good Genetics up right now. And looking at Playfair Little Beaver's progeny list, because I was going to bring him up. So this kind of to play into something for you. So we have Playfair Little Beaver. He was a purebred buck who was born in 1973. Okay. And Playfair Little Beaver had American Alpine progeny and French Alpine progeny. He also had purebred Oberhausley progeny. Okay. And I don't mean like 3-4 generations out and eventually he had descendants. No, these are somebody chose when registering at this point whether or not to register their animal Alpine or Oberhausley or experimental. But Sodium Oaks, I believe it was Jamaica. Gave birth to Sodium Oaks Kiwi Mallow.
Yes.
Kiwi Mallow was the dam of Sodium Oaks Saison. So when you look at Sodium Oaks Saison, on the dam side, his grand dam. Grand dam was out of a purebred Oberhausley. And that's top and bottom on Kiwi Mallow, because Royal Risk Grand Dam is Kiwi Mallow. Royal Risket the Buck, who's sire of Sason.
So when they started the Oberhausley herd book, it was my understanding that Donald Smith had the choice to put Kiwi Mallow either in the Oberhausley herd book or in the Alpine herd book. And he chose to put her in the Alpine herd book, which made Sason an Alpine as well. So even though they did have the Oberhausley bloodline blood in them, but he chose to put them in the Alpine herd book. That was what I was told.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was under the impression too. Someone may correct us though.
Yes, someone may correct us.
Well, I want to keep going on and talking a little bit about American versus purebred, because I don't mean to dwell on it, but I'm just kind of curious here. Are there some differences in terms of their conformation or milk production that if I was interested in Oberhausleys, I should know about?
So I'm going to say difference in style to me is the biggest thing. And it kind of comes into your milk production, I suppose, as far as mammary. The style is, they tend to be a little finer boned.
Yes.
And they're a little, they're not, you know, Brandy's does are out in her barn. You heard how her barn is. I don't believe the purebred would do as well there. Not many northern purebred herds, except if you hit New England in New York. Then they tend to be more purebred Oberhausley herds. Or if you hit, where's Meadow Song from? Wisconsin, Minnesota area.
Yeah, I think he's in Wisconsin.
But they're a little finer boned, and they tend to have the older style general appearance, okay, meaning they're a little steeper in the rump. Mm-hmm. They are definitely a dairy animal, at least the ones I've seen, tend to have a dairiness about them. I used to call it dairy character, now it's dairy strength. But for whatever reason, most purebreds generally aren't known for production. We happen to have one out here who is. Goodness, she was, the total performer this year at Nationals. 6-year-old doe, who's happens to be purebred. I think mainly it's in the body style. Unfortunately, generally speaking, the body style of the purebreds has trouble keeping up with the Americans. A friend of ours up here in central New York has a beautiful purebred Oberhausley herd. Red Doe is the herd name and owned by Candace Patney. And she's got a gorgeous buck up there. Red Doe, 8SNL, artisan. And, you know, she's shown him and he's competed against American Oberhausley bucks. And he finished. He's permanent champion up there in an area where people started showing a lot more Americans. But when it comes to production, generally speaking, they generally don't keep up with the Americans. That's my take on it. I don't know, Brandy, you agree?
Yeah, I agree. They don't keep up in production. They tend not to keep up it in the show ring here. They're usually lighter boned. They have steeper rumps. They have narrow rumps, higher dorsal processes. The udders tend to be not as well attached. A lot of purebreds have bulbous teats. So it's, you know, goats like Cream in the purebred gene pool, she's kind of an anomaly. She's not what most of the purebreds look like. It's really a shame that they can't get Cream cloned. she's really a very, very, very nice animal.
We try.
Yeah. But to me, The Americans tend to be stronger. They have more snugly attached mammary systems. They have wider rumps. Their strength of bone is more substantial. They're just overall just a stronger, more ideal dairy goat for longevity than a purebred is. And I'm not putting purebreds down. There's definitely a place for purebreds. Absolutely. Because, that's where you get those really beautiful sculpted heads and you get those long snaky necks and the super yep. nice, beautiful front ends and stuff like that. My herd tends to suffer from being a little chunky in the front. I wish that I could get that super sharp dairiness that purebreds are known for, but it's very difficult to get that without losing everything that you've come forward with, like, especially in the mammary system. I've used old semen and, I do get those bodies that I'm looking for, but I lose my mammary systems. Yep. That's the problem with the breed is it, you know, like La Mancha's and Alpines. If you breed a doe with a decent udder to a buck whose dam has an excellent udder, chances are your udder is going to improve. You have a much higher chance of improving your mammary system on these other breeds than you do in Oberhausli. And with Oberhausli, it is a crapshoot. It really is. You can take, a herd, or you can take an animal that has five generations of E mammaries and say, and breed her to a buck that also has five generations of E mammaries, and you can get a plus mammary or an acceptable mammary. It's a total, total crapshoot when it comes to the breed. It's really frustrating.
So, yeah, I agree with you, Brandy. I was going to interject here with a little bit of case study here on the cream of the crop. If you look her up, that's actually her name, the cream of the crop. We bought her off a 4-H family who was getting out of goats. She's a purebred doe and, you know, beautiful. She was a beautiful doe. As you mentioned, that beautiful Oberhausli head, the long feminine neck, nice front end. She's a very dairy doe, deep bodied. She freshened in with a beautiful mammary as a first freshener. We have AI'd her, Body Shop's Cabernet, Irish Rogue, and we don't think we've quite gotten the quality that she is. And those are some top quality or good quality Oberhausli box. With your help, Brandy, we've gotten some Pleasant Field Nick. What we want to try on her or her daughter. And we've also had another friend put us in touch with some Rapscallion, which is another buck from way back when, just to see if we can get a similar quality and yet still kind of maybe stir up the gene pool a little bit there. But in doing so, I don't think we're getting the quality. I know where the quality is. Yeah. It seems a little sacrilegious to some people to think about breeding the purebred doe to the American or the experimental buck. But that may happen.
So I'd like to poke a bear here a little bit. Do you guys mind?
Not at all. Please do. Okay.
There are two bears I want to poke a little bit. To me, again, sitting at ringside at Nationals, it seemed very evident to me that there were different types when you looked at heads. And there were some heads on the does out there that to me looked like the Oberhausli heads that I always grew up being in love with. Little bat wing ear, you know, the
yep.
little tiny ears.
I love those ears.
Little ears that are set down low and the eyeballs that are so big.
Yes, the bulgy, like, the bulgy eyes, the broad across the forehead.
They're like Arabian.
Yes.
They're the Arabian
yes,
if it's yes, dairy
goat. Perfectly
yeah.
put.
I just wanted to sigh when I saw those little heads because I just think they're so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then you saw other heads that I'm like, uh-huh. Yep. Those look like you would find in the American Alpine herd.
Yep. Yep.
So
yes, you are poking a bear.
Okay. So can we, do you guys want to chew on that a little bit?
You know, I'm going to try to play. Oh, Brandy, you go first.
Oh, don't do that to me. So, yes, there are definitely animals that do resemble alpine much more than they resemble Oberhasli. And so to me, as a, even though I'm not a purebred person, I am still an Oberhasli purist. I won't cross my Oberhasli with an alpine. I know a lot of Oberhasli breeders are starting to do that because they want to improve their herds faster. Because let's face it, the alpine, you know, their alpine are, they're a, I don't want to say superior.
Alpines tend to win best in show more often than the Oberhasli.
Yeah, and they go along the continuum. How's that?
Yes. Thank you. That's wonderful. So I know that a lot of Oberhasli people are starting to bring in alpine bloodlines to improve their Oberhasli. And for me, I just can't get behind that. I just can't do it. There are so many good Oberhasli out there now. It just takes a little bit of time and you have to have a little bit of patience. I don't know. To me, using an alpine buck on an Oberhasli is cheating. I mean, it's because especially when you lose so much of that Oberhasli type when you cross with an alpine, you get those narrower front ends like an alpine has than an Oberhasli. Oberhasli tend to be very boxy. They're very broad in the front end and very, very just, you know, they look like bulldogs in the, at least mine do, look like bulldogs in the front ends. And it kind of goes with the head and the whole thing, the whole shape all the way down from the wide foreheads and the little tiny ears. And it goes all the way down into that wide chest and goes all the way back. That's the breed character. And when you bring in those alpines with those little bit more narrow heads and those longer, snipier noses, and then the front ends are a little sharper and tighter and narrower, more narrow than the Oberhasli, that just doesn't do it for me. To me, bringing in the alpine is taking away a huge part of what makes an Oberhasli, and that's that beautiful sculpted head with those teeny tiny ears and those big eyeballs and those broad foreheads, and I just won't do it. And you can definitely tell the animals that have alpine in them when they're in the ring compared to the goats, that the Oberhasli that do not.
So, Brandy, you're as a judge, and so, you know, Nate and I as the non-judges here, but, you know, I know that I hear all the time at training conferences, you know, the whole idea of that unified scorecard is that, you know, you should be able to put a bag over their head and the body should be consistent through the rest of them. But I see exactly what you're saying. You can look at an Oberhasli, and tell that is an Oberhasli, yes, just from its silhouette. I don't care if you're looking, we're going to talk about color, but not talking about color right now. Just the way that Oberhasli is put together, I think is very unique for the breed. And I really appreciate that. I just didn't know how much throughout the breed that is emphasized or not.
So go ahead.
I will chime in here on that a little bit. You know, I did hear, I had a unique opportunity of also being at TC this year. And I did hear a bit from the judges, you know, helping organize and, you know, score the other judges, mention of a breed character, breed being part of general appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the head and breed character is part of general appearance. It is something to consider. You know, it is a minor element, but it is there. And when you're looking, especially at a national show stage or show ring, it is something that sometimes, you know, the first difference between first, second, or third might be that little bit. Whether it's an alpine-looking head, whether it's on the width of the black stripe down the back, whether it's shade, whether it's the incurvature of the nose, the concave or the convexing of a nose, convexing being a fault, mind you. That head and breed character, it's there, and it should not be forgotten as we are breeding better and better animals.
Especially on the national level, because that national champion is that animal of all the breeds, that national champion is supposed to represent the breed specifically. So when when your Oberhausli national champion has a little bit of an alpine type head, then a lot of people, especially newbies, they're going to start to say, oh, well, okay. So the Oberhausli doesn't have to have that sculpted head that it's supposed to have, the Oberhausli doesn't, you know, it can be super tall and long and alpiney looking. That's okay, because that's what the national champion is. And so for me as a judge, like La Mancha's, for example, I would not unless she was really, really, really just perfect in every other way, shape, and form, I would prefer to put up an elf-eared, a gopher-eared La Mancha over an elf-eared La Mancha.
Yep.
Just because it's, you know, the
head and breed character.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what and same with togs. Togs are supposed to have those really beautiful, small, sculpted heads. Toggenburg heads are beautiful. They're very similar in type to an Oberhausli head. And when you get a tog that has a slightly Roman nose, or she's a little snipey in the pinched in her nose at the end or something, or it doesn't look right. And so you're losing your breed characteristic. Yes, you should have the unified scorecard, and you should be able to put a bag over their head, etc. But at the same time, you shouldn't be losing your breed character for your specific breeds. Otherwise, why don't we all just have Alpines, or why don't we all just have whatever's? Nubians, they have a very distinctive body. a Nubian, you know, a Nubian does not look like an Alpine, regardless of what the scorecard says.
If you say unified scorecard, you put the bag over the head in Nubian, but her ears don't touch her nose. They don't even come to the corner of the mouth.
Or she has the flat, or she doesn't have the Roman nose that she's supposed to have. See, to me, the ears are very important. And a lot of times when I'm judging, I will actually grab the ears of the goat to see if her ears are past her nose like they're supposed to be. And I've had a lot of people say, wow, you're the first judge that's ever done that. I'm like, it's a breed characteristic. It's supposed to be there.
I'm trying to remember who the judge was. When I was younger, there was a judge who, she said her favorite breed to judge was the Nubian, because she could go up to each and every one of them, and she had a reason to give each one a kiss if she wanted to, because that's how she checked the ears. She'd get right in front of them. She'd pull the ear right towards her. You know, it was a little bit silly, but at the same time, she got a good look at where did those ear tips go? How far forward did they come? Was that nose Roman? Was it concave? Dish fake?
So, okay, guys. So I'm going to poke the cousin bear to that. Let's talk about color.
Color.
Okay, so
as a baseline, what color are they supposed to be?
Bay. They are supposed to be bay, not chamoisé. Chamoisé is more of a tannish color. Bay. They are supposed to have a red hue to their coat. Whether they can be a light bay or they can be a deep red bay. But they are supposed to have a red tint to their coat. They're not supposed to be brown. They're not supposed to be tan. They're not supposed to have swirls in their belly markings. They're not supposed to have swirls on their cheeks or have the black dots on their cheeks. It's supposed to just be a black mask and black facial stripes down. So they are a bay goat. They are not. I know that the breed standard says chamoisé, but then it goes on to specify red bay or any shade of bay. So, which, you know, you start getting into these horse colors. A lot of Nigerian dwarf people use horse colors to describe their goats. And so it's kind of weird that way. So, but no, they are supposed to be bay, not brown, not tan, not orange. They're supposed to be bay.
And I remember, you know, back when, you know, they were talking,
and not two-tone.
No two-tones. But I got reminded, you know, by my father, who was way back then. He was director way back then. But he reminded me one time when we were discussing color on Oberhasli that they put it as bay and left it as kind of, you know, bay because they wanted a bit of variability because you couldn't have – you know, if you left it as a certain color marker, like this specific hue, you're going to, you know, it'd be impossible.
You're going to be knocking a lot of animals out of the herd book.
Exactly. Exactly. So they put it as bay, you know, from light bay to dark bay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where kind of on the market with people buying, selling, breeding, retaining, animals, that's what falls on them, say what to them is ideal. Now we have, I'd say we have a medium bay Oberhasli in our herd in general. Periodically we will get a dark red bay. And the interesting thing for us is, and it's kind of brought up moral questions for us, is we've had people say, we want a buck out of that doe. And the main reason for wanting a buck out of that doe is she's a dark bay. And it's like, well, yeah, what about this one who has a really nice forerunner?
Yeah. And color is important in the breed. It is very important in the breed because just like with the head, it is a breed characteristic. But like Nate kind of is alluding to, you know, don't only focus on that deep red bay because there's a lot of really nice quality Oberhasli out there that might be a lighter bay. And when I say lighter bay, I'm talking like kind of a dark strawberry blonde kind of thing. Does that make any sense? It does.
Yeah.
And the problem, it's really hard to articulate the color, describing the color. You just have to breed. You have to live with the breed in order to understand what's correct and what's not correct. When a kid is born on my place, I can tell the minute it comes out if it's the correct color.
Oh, yeah.
And so do you guys find that color, like if you have a dam that is a beautiful dark bay, is she more apt to throw a dark bay or is it really hit and miss?
It's hit and miss. You can breed a blood red buck to a blood red doe and you can get a goat with white hairs scattered throughout. Again, yeah. The breed is so difficult to have consistency like that with. I have a doe that I bred to a buck this year, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I bred a goat to a goat. Anyway, and she had a buck doe twins, and the buck was so dark. He is blood bay. I mean, he is so dark and so rich and so beautiful and so, just really, really nice. And his sister is chamoisé. She's washed out. She doesn't have any red hue to her coat whatsoever. And I'm like, what the heck? It's like the buck sucked all the color gene out. He got all the ink. Yeah, he totally sucked up all the ink. And the doe, I ended up selling the doe kid as a grade to a pet home because her color was so screwed up. And it sucked because she was drop dead gorgeous. I mean, this was a beautiful kid. And I'm like, dang. So I actually repeated that breeding with the hopes that I can get that the doe kid will suck all the color up this year. So, and you never know that when with a repeat breeding, I may get two blood red kids, or I may get the vice versa of the doe being red and the buck being chamoisé, or I may get two chamoisés. You don't know. So you can't breed for color. You can't breed for color. And I have long, Farrell Fields said one time to somebody, I don't even remember who it was, but my mentor, Luann Tuttle, is the one that told me what he said. And he said, you have to build the barn before you can paint it. And so, yes, color is very important to me. And if I see a goat that is tan or is two-tone or is not the correct shade of bay that she should be, I am going to grade her down and get rid of her or whatever I'm going to do. But at the same time, I do not breed specifically for that deep red bay. I am more interested in conformation. I'm interested in good mammary systems. I'm interested in longevity. Bramble is going to be 12 years old this year. She's beat up. I mean, she's 12 years old. We're all beat up when we're that old. But she's deep red bay. She's a deep red bay doe. But she doesn't always throw that color. And so, you know, it is what it is. But that's what I want. I want those brambles in my herd that can, at 11 years old, still come in, 11 and 12 years old, still come in and get milked every day and earn their keep. They're not just eating hay. You know, she's still milking. She freshened in February and that old rag is still milking. So she is just such a good, she doesn't get on the milk stand. She won't jump on the milk stand. So we milk her on the ground, but she's still earning her keep. And that's more important to me than breeding for that deep blood bay that so many people think is so important.
Okay. So still talking a little bit about color. Your breed standard states black belly, mm-hmm. and it also talks about light gray to black udder. And I'm just going to say this. There were lots of pink udders I saw in the show, right?
Oh,
that so comes from...
I got that.
Oh, you got that, that one. You can do that
inside.
One. So yeah, it's because the goats don't go outside. They have to get... They're just like anything else. They have to be... Their udders have to be tan. But yes, I agree with you.
Seriously, our does, yep. when we clip them in May for the spring shows, they have shiny little pink udders.
Lily white udders, just like a butt that has not seen
it. Exactly. Your butt from, you know, not being outside, you know. So then spring comes. They've been clipped for the first show. By the time we get to the early summer shows, we all got these gray to tan udders, mm-hmm. These tanned udders, basically. And it's interesting because you can look at, like, some does, you can lift up that rear leg, and there's a little bit of pink right there.
Pink underneath because you didn't get the hair shaved underneath or the leg never goes, you know, never gets far enough away from the udder. So there's still pink underneath. And actually, Mark Baden is the one that told me, many, many, many years ago, he said, you need to shave your udder in spring so that it's the proper color. It's like, oh, okay. Live and learn.
No, thank you for explaining that. I always wondered about that because I thought, I just don't see very many black to gray udders on most of the Oberhousleys. So
no, it's because the goats are either living inside all the time and they don't get exposed because there is a breeder whose animals are inside the majority of the time just because of the way their barn is set up. So those udders don't get a whole lot of sun. And there's a lot of breeders that don't clip their udders in the spring. You know, they wait until nationals or they wait until whenever, not getting that close because they're not showing their goats because they're planning on going to nationals. So they're not taking them out anywhere. So they don't bother to shave their udders. So they're not tanned. Right. They're not getting any sun to them.
I do want to ask you to, Because I've noticed that both of you have some experimentals. Brandy, you've got your famous tomato soup line there. Yes. And then, Nate, I've seen soup, that on yep. your website you've used an experimental buck before. What? How are you guys using yep. those in the Oberhasli breed there? Obviously, it's a color breed, and we need to be the right color. And you and Brandy, you've already talked about how you put goats in the raw in the great herd book. But how are you guys kind of using those in your Oberhasli lines there?
So you know, you're referring to Lux or Luxuriant. He is actually Van Just Luxuriant. Guess where he comes from. he's an experimental buck. He's second generation conforming. One of Brandy's does. Beautiful doe. Diamond, she's first generation conforming. That's his dam. Her dam had a non-conformance issue, and so Brandy pulled her out of the herd book, and that's how you end up with this issue. Now, Lux's daughters are all American. Lux's sons are experimental bucks, but their bucklings are American. And so that's the background on Lux. There's a lot to say about Lux. We love that buck. His daughters are a specific type. They've got that level rump. They've level flat rump from you know hooks to pins, thorough to thorough. They've beautiful mammaries. Years ago, someone said, you know, buck will fix everything. Lux doesn't fix everything, but he does a darn good job.
Yeah, he's a really, really good buck. So to answer your question, how we incorporate that into the Oberhasli herd book. So the tomato soups go back to 50% Nubian, 50% Oberhasli doe. And so basically what they look like is they look like a paper brown bag Nubian with black trim. So you know, the kind of Nubians that I'm talking about, they're just kind of plain and they're brown and they just have a little bit of black trim. Well, that's the markings that are on these tomato soup goats. And, so we have found that, for the most part, there was an exception. The Funks actually had one throw back to, but it looked more like yes. a Tog Oberhasli cross than a tomato soup. It was really a kind of a strange looking little dude. Anyway,
yes.
once they go to the Oberhasli, correct Oberhasli color with the black bellies and the black legs all the way up, because the tomato soups only have black in the front. They don't have black markings in the backs of their legs. They don't have the full black facial stripes. They don't. And a lot of times on their black on their dorsals, on their backs, will have that circle, you know, do you guys know what I'm talking about? You know how Nubians will sometimes have like this circle in the middle of yep. their black yep. that's a brown spot?
Yes.
The tomato soups will do that a lot of times as well. So, but once they get that correct black belly and the correct facial markings and the black legs and stuff, they don't go back to tomato soup. We did, just as an experiment, we bought a tomato soup buck from Jessica Miller in New York. He was sired by a correct Oberhasli colored buck, and he was out of one of our tomato soup does. And he was a tomato soup himself, this buck kid was. And we bought him and brought him in because we wanted to see if we could actually bring that tomato soup back in after they've gone to Oberhasli. And we did. 75% of his kids were tomato soup colored. It was very interesting. But what was really kind of bizarre about that is they didn't have the red hue to their coats that they're supposed to have as an Oberhasli. They were more of a brown color. So yeah, it was very, very interesting. They don't look like our 50-50 Oberhausli, or they don't have the same color. It's bizarre. So it makes me wish that I knew more about genetics, you know, how the genetic strands fall together and the DNA strands fall together and stuff. But anyway, to answer your question, the our strongest animals come from that 50-50 Nubian Oberhausli cross. That's why we have so many recorded grades in the barn right now, because they're so strong. They have beautiful mammary systems. They're strong does, beautiful color, just really, really, really nice goats. And I know that I was saying a little while ago that I wouldn't bring Alpine in because I'm such a purist with the Oberhausli, but this was a complete fluke. We had this Oberhausli doe that Vanessa wanted when she was a little girl, and we didn't have anything to breed the goat to. So she was bred to a spotted Nubian buck. And she had full on massive spots on this buck. His name was Spotted Eagle, if that tells you anything. So, and she had this little red doe. That looked like a baby deer. And I told Vanessa, if you can tame that, because we dam raised her, I said, if you could tame that little doe down, you can keep her. And that she did. And that was fawn. And that was the foundation for this tomato soup thing that we've gotten into. So it wasn't like we did it intentionally. It just kind of happened that way. And those animals have actually been some of the strongest animals that we've had. And the buck that that Nate was talking about that they have, he comes from there. In fact, that, let's see, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother. That original doe was his great-grandmother. So, he throws those Nubian, those Nubian qualities, those beautiful foreheaders and those wide rumps and stuff like that. And that comes from, that does come from the Nubian.
But still maintaining the Oberhausli traits as well, though.
Right. What was that, Laura?
Are they loud? Do they have voice?
No.
Actually, that's the irony.
They have no Nubian personality whatsoever. Isn't that a trip?
In fact, so one of the things about the Oberhausli is that they are generally a quiet breed. The loudest thing in my barn is the chickens.
And the guineas.
And the guineas. Oh, my goodness, the guineas. Anyway, our Lox daughters are even more quiet than the rest of the herd. You can pick one out because she's the quietest doe in the herd.
Brandy
has one. Has a Lux daughter at your house, right?
Yeah, and she's so quiet, she's so calm, she's so chill. And I actually have a line of Oberhausli. These are 100% Oberhausli, according to Adjugo Genetics, and they are so loud. Oh my God. I'm like, what happened to you guys? You are not following the rules of the game here. And it is a specific bloodline. The buck is noisy. Bucks aren't noisy. The buck is noisy and all of his daughters are noisy and they're terrible. I can't stand it. But so no, the Nubian, the tomato soups are so quiet and so calm and so chill, and everything that comes from them is the same way. It's wonderful.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. They're such good goats. They really are good goats. I hate this term. That whole hybrid vigor thing. They've got it going.
I was just going to bring that up. Like, there's a bit of hybrid vigor in having outcrossed, you know, way back with fawn, in bringing in that Nubian genetic, and it stuck with the bloodline. And as they were brought into the Oberhausli, you know, they kept certain traits like that wide rump, that levelness from thorough to thorough. That dorsal process that we mentioned earlier was a problem on the purebred Oberhausli's. And it still is, mind you, because that's one of Cream's weaknesses. it's not an issue here on those lock starters. It's level from thorough to thorough. You get that, yeah, that fore udder, as well as a nice rear udder, that nice rear udder arch, which again, you can probably trace all the way back to those Nubians. Mm-hmm. We have to keep in mind that, when you're dealing with American Oberhasles, American Sonnens, Togs, whatnot, somewhere back there, there's either a paper that lapsed mm-hmm. or an outside genetic influence. And the thing to look at is, what was that genetic influence? Was it a good influence or a bad influence?
Yes.
And when you can find a buck or a doe who's making a good genetic influence in your breeding program, even if they are experimental, that's something to include. And that's how we look at Lux. He's got the good genetic influence there, and he's got the traits we're looking for to improve in the Oberhasles. And that's why and how we're using him.
It seems to me like that's a good rule of thumb for anybody considering using an experimental buck, whether it's Oberhasle or any other breed, kind of knowing what's back there and realizing that it's going to rear its head somehow. It's going to be expressed somehow.
It may be. Now, Randy mentioned it. We had a complete throwback. In fact, that kind of became his nickname of Lux is a conforming Oberhasle buck. You look at him, he was bred to actually a nice dark red Oberhasle doe. And the result was what turned out to be this alpine looking thing.
Yeah, he looked like a Toggenburg Oberhasle cross. He didn't even look like a tomato soup specifically. He almost had white on him and stuff. I'm like, where did that come from?
Yeah. I mean, he had the Toggenburg, that nice dark, rich Toggenburg brown.
He had some white on his, or cream. It wasn't even white. It was like a cream. And the tomato soups, they don't have any cream on them at all. So he had like cream stripes on his face and his legs, if I remember correctly.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, he would have made a great alpine.
Yeah, he really would have. I was like, are you guys sure that another buck didn't get to her?
But we only have Oberhasles. So there was that one genetic, throwback. We've often thought about trying to repeat that breeding. In fact, that's the plan for this year, because it was now structurally.
Yeah, structurally, he was really pretty.
You did a black and white silhouette of the animal. He was spot on. He's what you wanted. He was mm-hmm. sharp at the withers. He had a long neck. He was level across the top line. Nice, strong set of feet and legs. But yeah, first off, it was he was not conforming.
So I want to go ahead and I want to talk, thinking where the breed is going as well here. Thinking long term here in the next 5, 10, 20 years. Obviously, Oberhasles have came a long way and in my opinion, a very short amount of time. But where's the breed going in the next couple of years or down the road, 10, 20 years down the road?
I personally would like to see production go up across the board on the breed. They're not very prolific milkers. And so I would like the Oberhasle to have higher production across the board. It's very common. The average milk production on an Oberhasle is about 2,200 pounds. Which is really, for a standard breed goat, that's not very high. I would prefer to see it more along the 3,000 mark. Without the problem with it, a 3,000-pound milking Oberhasle is that they tend to, because they're not a very big goat, they tend to be hard to keep healthy. They just don't thrive as well when they're milking that much. And I would prefer it if there was more production in the breed with them maintaining their health, if that makes any sense at all.
So it does to me, because I have a perfect example of it. Gretchen.
Oh, yeah.
So Gretchen was the 2016 reserve junior champion in nationals. We ended up with her as a yearling milker. As a yearling milker, she had a beautiful doe. Okay. She milked, you know, 6 to 7 pounds a day. She was a beautiful little doe. We had a lot of fun showing her. As a 2-year-old, she freshened. And she was making 10 to 12 pounds a day. But body wasn't able to keep up with the production.
See, and at 10 to 12 pounds, that's not that much milk, really. Yeah, so if she was struggling to maintain her body on 10 to 12 pounds, that's not the ideal dairy goat. That's the problem with the breed as a rule, unfortunately.
And then because she wasn't, you know, and then the following year she upped to about 14 pounds.
Yeah.
And the issue there was the mammary was larger than the attachments were able to hold it.
Mm-hmm. So that was an example of an animal that had the will to milk. They just didn't have that strength to sustain.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. We ended up selling her because we felt that we weren't able to care for her the way that she could be. New owner, quite frankly, backed her right off. A high carb diet, low production, reduced that milk output, and she did a lot better. At that time, we weren't, able to take care of that sort of situation. But what we've since found is if you breed the goat so that you have the room, you have the attachments and the mammary to then have does who are producing, 10 pounds a day, 10, 12 pounds a day, or even 13. Then yes, you can start getting up there with production. We're starting to see the production numbers going up with the Oberhasli as breeders are looking to improve the attachment and improve the capacity on their does. Goodness, I mentioned it back in 1993, 94, I had a doe that finished as a permanent champion. I can tell you right now, she milked 5 pounds a day, back then.
And
yeah, and she was average for an Oberhasli at the time, at least in the Northeast. Then, to now have does in my barn that are doing over 10, 11 pounds a day, it's almost a pipe dream compared to then. So I think we're getting there. I think I want to say we're catching up towards where alpines are now, but I also know that alpines and all good breeders should be doing are moving forward themselves. So I do see that we're trying to get the production, but I also see we're trying to get the production with the body to hold it rather than just big mammaries with lots of milk and not able to sustain it.
Yeah. That's definitely a problem with the breed as a rule, is that they just don't have the bodies to go with the milk when they start becoming higher milkers. So last year, or in 2017, the number one producing Oberhasli was 3,560 pounds. That's number one. And then the number 10 animal milked 2,600 pounds. That really, if you think of those numbers, that's actually kind of pathetic. And this is my breed that I'm talking about. And we as breeders should be focusing on production for our animals and breeding animals. Okay, so Saanen. The number one Saanen doe in 2018 milked 5,750 pounds, and the number 10 Saanen milked 4,490 pounds. In 2018, the number one Oberhausli milked 3,680 pounds. So we were 1,000 pounds less, almost 1,000 pounds less from our number one animal to the number 10 Saanen. And that's just, and the Oberhausli, you know, they eat as much as a Saanen does. So we as breeders should be focusing on breeding animals that can produce more milk and earn their keep a little bit better. I had a doe that milked a little over 3,000 pounds last year, and she did it pretty effortlessly. And I AI'd her, and she had triple bucks, and I kept one of those bucks for myself because I am going to try to bring, I've got the bodies, I've got the mammary systems. I want to start to bring that production back into my animals because the breed has lost a lot of the production that it had even 10 years ago, because we've been concentrating so much on fixing the mammary system and getting the goats to have better conformation that we've lost sight of what they're actually supposed to be doing, and that's milking.
So to put it bluntly or more directly in reference to scorecards, I think you're going to find people aiming at trying to improve the dairy strength of the Oberhausli breed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, looking at that flatness of bone and spring of rib, that those dairy strength traits, incorporating them in a breed where, yes, we've been focusing on the mammary, we've been focusing on the general appearance, and trying to incorporate that more.
Kind of to wrap all this up, because this is just fascinating. And again, I'm not an Oberhausli breeder, but I have learned so much from just listening to you guys' back and forth. And I mean, this
there
is
was a point in the podcast where Laura and I were texting each other, and we were just like, we're going to let you two go, and then we'll just come back and edit it.
Kind of to wrap things up, if you had to sell me on why someone should get an Oberhausli, what would you say? What is your elevator pitch to get somebody to get into Oberhauslis?
For me, it's temperament. Yeah. Oberhausli are so chill. They really are. They're very calm. They're very just go with the flow. Not much bothers them. Cameron mentioned my big feeder that we put out in the thing. And I got a bunch of private messages from people saying, how do you fill that with the goats out there? And I'm like, we drive the tractor in with the bale of hay and we stick it in the feeder. And they're like, they're not jumping on the tractor, or they're not losing their minds, or they're not getting in the way or doing anything like, no, they're so calm and they're so smart, and they're a very easygoing breed of goat for people with high strung personalities like myself.
And I'm going to say that's exactly it too, as far as the sales pitch. You know, I've got, two animals I can tell you a quick, really quick story on both of them. One's a story and one's just a fact. One day we were out, we had pulled the milk stands out of the barn. We were milking outside, you know, quite frankly, on the lawn, just because it was a hot day and there was a slight breeze and we wanted to be in the breeze. But at the end of June, and the neighbor was holding a graduation party and had hired a fireworks display. And they, of course, you can't aim it into for the debris to fall into the woods or on the houses. So you aim it in the open field, quite frankly, where, you know, near where the people are milking the goat. And those fireworks went off throughout chore time. None landed on us. But going off right over our head, and the doves were just literally bomb-proof. They were eating their grain and looking at the kids and who were sitting watching the fireworks display. We weren't bothered by it. Okay.
Okay, and I love my alpines. They never would have stood that. I don't know if you're honestly pulling the milk stands out of the barn. I don't think they would have been happy with either.
Then the other thing is we have a few bucks, 3 bucks from Brandy, but one of them was the 2018 Spotlight Sale buck, the Leocadia.
2019.
You're right, 2019. And you know, my daughter, who's 10, can take him by the collar. It's rot. Those girls want the boys want the girls. She can take him by the collar, walk him down the barn with the girls sticking their heads out going, Leo, and put him right in his pen and shut the gate. Yeah. She weighs, what, 65 pounds?
And that's the thing here, too, is all my bucks in full rut, they're like, okay, cool. They will come when they're called. They'll come with, you say their name and they'll come. And I have a lead rope that I keep out there, and I'll put the lead rope, hang it over the fence. And whatever buck I've called will come and stick his head in the lead rope because they know that that's what it's for. And the other bucks have learned, it's not our turn. They don't rush the gate. They don't, they're just so well-mannered. Emma has been breeding bucks, using bucks to breed her own goats for the last 5 or 6 years. I did have a buck, which Cameron knows this buck very well. His name was Salute, and that buck was not a nice buck. He was very, very mean. He was very dangerous, and nobody was allowed to handle that buck. But I didn't keep him around for very long because of that. I used that buck. I had him collected, and then I would send him off to other herds because he was not a nice buck. And thankfully that personality did not come through to his daughters. I don't know why he was like that. He just was not a very nice animal, but the animal, they're a very chill breed.
In my opinion, one of probably, if not one of the most influential herd sires of the 2010s in the Oberhasli breed, for those Oberhasli enthusiasts, in my opinion, there. Yeah. But I want to wrap up here. Absolutely. Again, we could talk for hours upon hours. But thank you so much, Nate and Brandy, for joining us this week. It's been really insightful. Even if you're not an Oberhasli breeder like Laura and myself, and there's so many things and little nuggets of wisdom that you can pull out on the stories that you guys told. So thank you so much. Why don't you two go around and say where we can find more information on your goats if the listeners are interested in becoming Oberhasli enthusiasts?
Well, you can find us. We're on Facebook at Half Barn Farm Dairy Goats. We're also on Weebly at Half Barn Farm Dairy Goats.com. Or track me down, Nathan Funk, on Facebook.
I am also on Facebook, Van Just Oberhasli. And then we have a website. It's also Weebly. It's Van Just hyphen or dash, I guess, Oberhasli.com. And you can contact us through the Van Just page, or you can contact me directly about the goats or anything. And I'm more than willing to talk to anybody that wants to know anything. I wish that we could have touched a little bit more on the historic herds and that kind of thing, but we just, we have so much, there's so much passion for the breed, that it's very easy for both of us to just sort of go on and just start talking and not be able to stop. I love this breed. My heart belongs to the Oberhasli breed, and I they're just such wonderful. They're just such good goats. That's all I got. They're just such good goats.
And that's why we can have sequels and bring breeders back so that we can discuss things in more depth in the future.
Yeah, and try to stay with the outline more. So anyway, thank you
keep
very
me
much.
On track.
Yeah, I definitely need to be kept focused. I really appreciate you guys having me on again. I hope that that when you go through and you start editing everything that it that I make sense. And you're not like, oh God, we only have 10 minutes of footage that's in here for this one.
No, that's definitely staying in as well. As always, listeners, thank you for joining us this week. We do appreciate it. If you have any comments, concerns, feedback, let us know. We're available on Facebook. You can reach out to Laura or myself privately as well there. You can find us on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, really wherever you get your podcasts is all. Thank you, listeners, for this week, and we'll catch you on the next one.